Well, good evening to you. This is a special Ralph Miliband lecture, and we are extremely fortunate to have Professor Robert Reich as our guest this evening. Professor Reich is the Hoekstra Professor of Social and Economic Policy at Brandeis University, and also a very major public figure in the United States. I'm sure that I don't need to spell out Professor Reich's achievements. He has a string of very well-known academic books to his credit. He has also served in a number of American administrations, most recently under Bill Clinton as Secretary of Labor. By all accounts, one of the most successful and impressive secretaries of labor in recent history. In 2003, Professor Reich was awarded the Václav Havel Vision Foundation Prize. This, of course, in the name of the former president of the Czech Republic, for his pioneering work on economic and social history. In this lecture, Robert Reich is going to talk about the current state of American politics and of American socioeconomic developments, partly, of course, in the light of the last election, partly digging rather more deeply into longer-term trends in American politics and society. We are enormously grateful and enormously fortunate to have Professor Reich. Just before launching him on you, I've been asked also, though, to mention that the next Ralph Miliband lecture will take place on April the 26th and will be a panel discussion between Thomas Pogge, Ed Balls, and Robert Wade. I think I've now done my duty, but it's my great pleasure to welcome you here. Thank you very much indeed to coming to talk to us.
Thank you, Daniel. Well, Dominic, thank you so much. I think I'm going to, with your permission, get out from behind this podium so I can see a few of the people here. Can you all hear me? Can you still hear me? As you can see, my years in the Clinton cabinet wore me down. Politics, actually, in the United States, I don't know about how. Politics comes from the Greek root poly, meaning many, and ticks, small blood-sucking insects. That's... I shouldn't say that. I don't really believe that. In fact, it's a noble calling, and I've spent half my life, at least my adult life, in politics and half in the academy. And I hope many of you have an opportunity, if you're in the academy, to spend time in politics and vice versa. In each job, I've sort of drawn down the intellectual capital from the other. And I want to thank the committee that arranged this, the Ralph Miliband Committee, named after somebody who is one of my heroes, for inviting me tonight. The actual arrangements for this lecture were made before the last November's election. And when I was asked what I wanted to talk about, I said, well, that sort of depends upon the results of last November's election. I could, and I was trying to be completely dispassionate about it. I said I could, one title might be, depending upon who's elected, The Bright Promise of the Kerry Administration. The other title, just again to be completely neutral in an academic way, might be the ongoing disaster of the Bush administration. And unfortunately, my second title seems to be the one. No, actually, we came with a different one. What to expect from the second Bush administration and why? And so this is even more of a neutral academic lecture. And I will, quite sincerely, I'm going to put on my political science slash economics hat and not my partisan political hat. And I will talk for about 40, 45 minutes and then field whatever questions you may have. So if I say something that is even slightly provocative you would like to follow up on, please make a note and then we'll have an opportunity to engage in some sort of a dialogue. Let me start by saying that the second Bush administration has quite clearly, in the last 2 months, and it's only been 2 months, it seems like... I have to stop myself, you see. The second Bush administration has already announced, the president has announced, several of his objectives on domestic policy, for example, Social Security changes, the privatization or the creation of personal accounts, as he prefers to say. And secondly, with regard to taxes, under the rubric of tax reform, a fundamental change in the American system of raising tax revenues. There are other objectives as well. There's been talk of changes in what is called Medicaid. There have been talk of changes in immigration policy. And in foreign policy, although the administration has not been quite explicit about what its economic or its political foreign policy will be, we have some indications. John Bolton, who I've known for many years, is the nominee to head the United Nations delegation from the United States. We have people like Paul Wolfowitz, who is the American nominee to become the head of the World Bank. Condoleezza Rice has embarked upon a much more engaging and aggressive round of discussions with foreign leaders about American foreign policy, signaling, or at least perhaps attempting to signal, a more collegial foreign policy rather than the unilateral foreign policy of the first administration. Now, what I want to say tonight, and I'll give you the large themes before I illustrate the themes. The large theme is this. Most of all of the initiatives that I've already mentioned, in fact, I doubt any of them will actually bear any fruit whatsoever. In other words, Social Security will not be changed. The tax code will not be changed in any substantial way. Immigration reform will not occur. And again, all these initiatives always bear the word reform after them. So I don't mean to suggest that it's actually a reform of the immigration laws. That's the way it's been talked about. But there will be no change in immigration laws. There will be no change, really, in any domestic policy. And I dare say there will not be very much by way of foreign policy either. Indeed, there will not be, depending upon your point of view as to American foreign policy, it will continue to be quite unilateral. That is, the Americans will continue to say, we Americans, I am an American, we will continue to say essentially that we have the right to unilaterally make foreign policy for much of the rest of the world. But there will not be an extension of American military aggression. And let me explain why before I go into the details. The reason that nothing will happen is that almost every one of those initiatives either requires an expenditure of money that the United States does not have, or it requires the expenditure of political capital that the Republicans, although they run both houses of Congress and the White House, do not have. The second part of my thematic overview, and I will again come back to details, is that there will, however, notwithstanding everything I've said, be a major, major set of confrontations in the second Bush administration that will all but consume the American political dialogue. And they will, by and large, have to do with religion. They will have to do with the separation, or the alleged separation, in the United States Constitution between church and state. They already have begun. Now, let me just get to some of the specifics. I don't know how many of you, I'm going to try to read your faces in terms of your capacity for boredom with regard. No, I mean it, because I talk about domestic policy and foreign policy quite a lot. My specialty is domestic policy, but I sound off about foreign policy. But with an audience of you, Brits, I don't know, frankly, how much you're interested in the details of American domestic policy. And so I'm going to just read your faces. To the extent that you are riveted, I'm going to continue to talk. If I see that your minds are all wandering way, way far away, I'm going to change the subject to a different domestic policy. Now, for example, but this is LSE, and so presumably there is some degree of interest in social policy, domestic policy. Let me just say something very quickly, and that is about Social Security. Social Security is the American, basically, pension policy, government policy for old age pensioners. It was started in 1935 by Franklin D. Roosevelt. It is the emblematic Franklin D. Roosevelt program, in terms of providing social insurance for people over the age of 65. And it's paid for on a pay-as-you-go basis. That is, people who are working now pay into a Social Security trust fund. It's really actually simply an accounting device that pays simultaneously for the Social Security premiums. Oh, people up there already, you're already. You're leaving. You're gone. You're absolutely gone. I'll speed up. But this is a big deal. And what George Bush, what the president wants to do, is basically transform the system into a system of privatized accounts in which people will have the chance, he would say, the liberty, to put their Social Security money, rather than a pay-as-you-go system in which my generation is paying for my parents. My father is 91 years old, and he's still collecting Social Security. Hopefully, when I get to be 65, my children and their generation will be paying into the system, but not if the president has his way, because if the president has his way, many young people will have the opportunity, quote-unquote, to take their Social Security payments and put it into private accounts. Now, there are problems with this, and I don't want to get, again, into too much technical detail with you, but you can see logically that if it's a pay-as-you-go system, then logically, if young people are taking money out of the system and putting it into private accounts, there is the question about how my generation, and I speak with some passion about this, my generation is ever going to get paid the Social Security due us when we've spent our working careers paying for our parents' generation's Social Security. So there is this kind of transition cost issue, and it's not a trivial issue. It's trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars. And you see, the president, and this is what the Bush administration, this is sort of an emblematic of the Bush administration, what the president is trying to do is create the impression in the public's mind that Social Security is in a state of crisis. In other words, that it won't be there for young people. There won't be enough people contributing into Social Security to mean that young people can draw out of Social Security. And to an extent, he's right in the sense that the baby boom bulge, this huge bulge of baby boomers, you have it in Britain as well. I mean, the population is aging. And so in the United States, you've got this big, big bulge of baby boomers who are moving through the demographics of the United States population like a pig through a python. Sorry. And obviously there is going to be some sort of an issue. And the Congressional Budget Office says it will be in about 2042. There are other estimates, maybe 2050. At some point in the future, there will be a question about how to sustain a pay-as-you-go system when a lot of the people paying in are going to shrink in number relative to the people taking out. And that's also quite logical. This isn't difficult to comprehend. But the interesting shift, the interesting, almost argumentative somersault that is being done by the administration is the one that says, if you allow young people to take money out of the Social Security system, put it into private accounts, you are thereby shoring up the Social Security system. Come again? Do you understand? It's not just illogical, it is almost absurd. How can you shore up a system if you're taking trillions of dollars out of the system? Even if we could afford it, even if there wasn't a giant budget deficit, this makes no sense at all. And what the president has started to say and started to admit publicly is that his plan to privatize is really not meant to shore up the Social Security system. In fact, it will not shore up the Social Security system. It's something entirely different. What is it then? Well, what is it? What it is an attempt, and this is very important, in ideological terms. It's an attempt to end the largest system of social insurance we have in the United States. And by privatizing, make countless Americans, at least in theory, shareholders, and therefore, as shareholders, less concerned, presumably, about all sorts of externalities that corporations might otherwise be concerned about, because laws require that corporations, for example, worry about the health and safety of their workers and worry about the environment and everything else. But of course, if in ideological terms there is no social insurance program at all, and if everybody has to rely on the stock market for their economic security, then everybody has a stake in making sure that corporations can maximize their profits And thereby, everybody has a stake in minimizing any kind of social restriction on the maximization of profits. You see, although the actual Social Security quote-unquote reform plan has no logic to it, in ideological terms, it is enormously logical. But of course, this is not discussed. It's not even clearly discussed by Democrats. I'll come to this in a moment. Now, just to put a finishing touch on this, you have to understand that the stock market in the United States, like the stock market in Britain, like most stock markets, are casinos. I mean, over time, yes, there is an average increase, but if you retire in a bear market, or if you've had bad luck with your investments, and you have no social security, no social insurance at all, you are, I'm sorry, out of luck. It was conceived by Franklin D. Roosevelt and his labor secretary, my predecessor, Francis Perkins, as a system of social insurance precisely to make sure that somebody would have, if they made bad decisions, or if they kind of fell on their face, or if there was a depression, and there had been a depression, make sure that there would be some economic cushion for people in old age. And that is what George W. Bush wants to get rid of. That economic cushion is very important. Now, I want to grant you something. I was a trustee. Are you still with me? You are with me. It's amazing. I can keep on talking about Social Security. I was a trustee of the Social Security Trust Fund in the early 1990s in my capacity as labor secretary. And what I discovered is projections, and this is something most of you know, projections about the solvency of a future trust fund, any projection, any economic projections at all, depend upon the assumptions that you put into the projection to begin with. And the trustees of the Social Security Trust Fund are dependent on that projection, or for that projection, on an actuary who puts these assumptions into a formula. And so everybody who estimates in the United States that Social Security will essentially run out of money or not be able to pay its full debts in the year 2042 or 2054, those actuarial projections are based upon a set of assumptions, and those assumptions are, in my view, extraordinarily conservative. For example, the assumption about U.S. economic growth over the next 75 years. Are you interested? You're moderately. I'll move on. I will. This is the last thing I'm going to say about this. But it's important because you have to get the entire, this is a metaphor for what is going on in the United States right now in terms of the paucity of public discussion about very important issues. The assumption on economic growth that is in the Social Security projection is 1.6% annualized economic growth per year. But if you look back in United States economic history to the Civil War, even considering and including the Great Depression, average yearly economic growth has been 3% per year. All the way back to the Civil War in the 1860s. And if you put in a 3% economic growth number in that assumption, what happens to Social Security? There is no Social Security problem whatsoever. It vanishes. Now, I'm willing to concede that those people who say there may be a problem with Social Security sometime in the middle of the 21st century, yes, there may be a problem, but I think that there probably won't be. But if there is a problem, you can make minor changes to the age at which you are eligible for Social Security or how much money you take out. Minor changes. I mean, when Franklin D. Roosevelt started Social Security, the lifespan of the average person in 1935 in the United States was 61 years old. And Social Security was available to you at your 65th birthday. It was not a great deal. But now the average lifespan is 78, so it's a much better deal. And there is an argument, particularly for people who are not doing hard labor, that maybe you increase the age of Social Security. I think that's permissible. And Alan Greenspan, in his infinite wisdom in 1983, did head a commission that suggested that, and that could be done. But what the Bush administration is doing is using this as a pretext for doing many, many other things. And what George Bush is not saying is that Medicare, which is our health program for people over 65, Medicare faces a real crisis. The unfunded liabilities of Medicare are about 7 times larger than the potential unfunded liabilities of Social Security. And yet, there is no discussion of Medicare whatsoever. Now, the reason nothing will happen on Social Security is that in the year 2006, every member of the House of Representatives and 1/3 of the Senate have to be reelected. They are up for reelection. And Social Security is extremely popular. And older people vote in great numbers. And the American public is not sold on the idea that Social Security needs reforming, because some of the arguments I've made to you, some of them, are somehow percolating through. And many of these representatives are nervous. Republicans don't want to bring up Social Security. And by the way, if these issues are not brought up this year, it's very, very hard to bring them up in an election year. And if they're not brought up this year and they're not brought up in the election year of 2006, you can bet they will not be brought up in the presidential run-up election years of 2007-2008. So this is the window of opportunity for the Bush administration. And that window is shutting extremely fast. And it's shutting also because everybody knows that the federal budget deficit is out of control. Let me just say something about this matter, because I know that here in the UK, Gordon Brown, your Chancellor of the Exchequer, has just decided, or at least he's made statements to the effect that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the European Union's decision to only allow, what is it, a 1% of the each member's national product, a deficit equal to only 1%. That's not true. Mary, what is it? 1% of the whole. 3% each, but it's 1% of the budget. All right. But I would say that Gordon Brown's decision is probably right on the basis that if it's investment in education or job training or health care, deficits are fine. The problem with the budget deficit in the United States is that it's not investment in education or health care or anything that builds up the productive capacities of Americans. That budget deficit is just pure spending and revenues that don't match those spending. A lot of it is what some of us have come to call corporate welfare. That is subsidies for big companies. Big companies that get the subsidies mainly because they have a lot of lobbyists in Washington, or they get tax subsidies because they have a lot of lobbyists in Washington. One thing that, again, the American public is not being told, and if you have any friends in the United States, please call them and tell them this, is that spending, if you look at the spending side of the ledger as a percentage of national product in the United States, spending actually, as a percentage of national product, is about the same as it's been over the last 20 years. That's not out of whack. What is out of whack in the United States, causing this budget deficit that keeps on growing, is on the revenue side. Revenues, as a percentage of national product, are the lowest they have been in 50 years. And why are revenues dropping? They are not dropping because of Social Security payroll taxes. Those are going up. Revenues are dropping because income and corporate taxes are going down. And who in the United States pays most of the income and corporate taxes? People who are relatively wealthy. In other words, we are going deeper and deeper into deficit in the United States because the wealthy got huge tax cuts in 2001 and 2003. Now, you would think that any reasonable discussion about what to do about the budget deficit in the United States would at least put on the table, at least have a suggestion, at least a minor possibility that maybe those tax cuts of 2001-2003 ought to be rolled back. It's not as if, let me emphasize this, it's not as if people who earned, say, over $200,000 a year were in terribly dire straits during the Clinton administration. They were doing fine. They did very well. In fact, they did better under the Clinton administration than they are doing under the Bush administration, even with the tax cuts. And so you would think that that would be on the table, and it is not. Instead, the Bush administration has now launched, under the guise of deficit reduction, a bunch of spending cuts, and most of those spending cuts, not surprisingly, are directed at people who are relatively poor. Public housing or housing vouchers. Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor. Job retraining, mostly for relatively poor people. And what does the Federal Reserve Chairman say about all this? The Oracle of Delphi, the wise man who is listened to profoundly, and nobody actually understands anything he says, but on this issue he's been very, very explicit. He says the deficits are terribly bad, and that what we ought to do is cut spending. He was in favor of the 2000 and 2000, 2001, 2003 tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy. What are Democrats saying? Very little. Very little. Let me go on just quickly to the other issue, and that is tax reform. If you followed my argument so far, very high deficits. Social Security reform that will cost huge amounts of money can't possibly be done given the high deficits. And now, thirdly, tax reform. Tax reform, and what does the Bush administration want to do? It wants to extend its tax cuts that it has given, mostly to wealthy people, on far beyond their date by which they are to end. Well, there is one tax cut in particular you may hear about, and this is the cut of the estate tax. In the United States, the estate tax, the inheritance tax, touches the top 2% by wealth. Top 2%. But the Republicans continue to call it the death tax, and has made the people of the United States, citizens of the United States, think that everybody pays it when they die. Well, of course, when you die, you don't pay it, but it affects everybody's estate, when in fact it only affects the top 2%. And on the basis of that misstatement, I don't want to call it lie, but on the basis of that misstatement, Congress passed in 2001 and then again 2003 a dramatic cut in the estate tax. But because of the strict budgetary guidelines, that cut ends in the year 2011, at which point the estate tax goes up again. Now, what's going to happen, of course, is at the end of 2011, on December 30th, 2011, if you have an elderly relative or you have a parent who is in some danger of death, you may be suggesting a kind of Dr. Gregorian kind of Gregorian, a kind of, I will get to this issue of assisted suicide in a moment, but... But it doesn't make any sense, and of course it's a setup to extend that tax cut indefinitely. Some of those tax cuts will be extended, but again, back to my theme, not many of them, because we cannot afford it, because you have this huge budget deficit. And that budget deficit, by the way, is directly related to the borrowing that the United States is doing from abroad. Huge borrowing. It's not just the budget deficit, it's also the fact that Americans don't save, but one reason that Americans are not saving is that median wages have gone absolutely nowhere. And if median wages are going nowhere, even baby boomers are not going to save. My generation of baby boomers in the United States assumed that our earnings trajectory over our lifetimes would look something like our parents' earnings trajectory, and therefore we did not save. In fact, our earnings trajectory, most baby boomers, has been rather flat. And we are approaching retirement, putting aside Social Security, we're approaching retirement without much by way of savings. We're spending more than we are saving. And that, parenthetically, is causing quite a problem, because I've done a little bit of a survey among baby boomers, kind of a free-floating focus group. And most baby boomers in the United States, who are quite entitled, I can say this is an entitled generation, they envision that their retirement will be a cross between Club Med and a medical facility. Snorkeling in the morning and extra oxygen in the afternoon. But of course, we can't afford that. But because Americans are not saving, and because the budget is going deep into deficit, and also because we are importing more than we are exporting, you have a huge problem on our hands, and that is enormous borrowing. And, of course, as many of you know, the Chinese Central Bank and the Korean Central Bank, South Korean, and the Japanese Central Bank have been helping us along with our borrowing needs, but that can't go on forever. The dollar is dropping, and the dollar will continue to drop. Warren Buffett is betting against the dollar. Bill Gates is betting against the dollar. There's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When people start betting against the dollar, well, the dollar will drop. And it's like any IOU. The dollar is simply an IOU. Like any IOU that's backed by somebody who is going deeper and deeper into debt, eventually creditors are going to say, forget it, we're not going to continue to support this IOU. And that is almost inevitably what is going to happen. Now, I don't want to get too technical on you, but this is LSE. And you know that eventually long-term interest rates in the United States will have to start going up. It's a little bit of a mystery why they haven't already. There are various theories about it, but long-term interest rates will have to go up because we've got to continue to attract capital. And Alan Greenspan is already raising short-term interest rates. This, in other words, cannot go on. This is why nothing I have said so far that the Bush administration wants to do, nothing will happen. But now we come to the more delicate question. What will happen if none of these initiatives will really amount to much? And by the way, foreign policy, you know how extended, how thinly spread American military troops are right now. Thinly spread over Afghanistan and also Iraq and around the rest of the world. And the only way, when we have an all-volunteer army, it's sort of a not really voluntary army. It's voluntary in the sense that you pay for the people who are going to so-called volunteer. But the only way to attract more people and high-quality people who have to manage complex weapon systems is you have to pay more. But where is the money going to come from to pay much more to get more troops? We don't have the money. And so some of you who are worried, perhaps, about a more adventuresome American foreign policy in the second term of the Bush administration, do not worry. There is no money there to do that. Until we come to what is really going to happen in the second Bush administration, all this has been a kind of predicate. All I've said so far is to set you up. The American public thinks all this is going to happen. It's not going to happen. But what is going to happen is, and has already started to happen, and that is a terrible fight in the United States over religious values. As some of you have heard already about this terribly tragic situation. A woman in Florida, Terry Schiavo, who has been her husband wants the feeding tube removed, and her parents do not want the feeding tube removed. It's a heartbreaking story. It's been going on now 15 years. This poor woman and her husband and her parents have been fighting about this for a long time. But the thing you need to understand about this is where the religious fight in America comes in. This is why this is significant. The issue is not the right to die or the right to live. The issue is respect for the rule of law. Let me explain. And this is very important. Decisions about right to life, decisions about when feeding tubes can be extracted, decisions about what patients in vegetative states or comas really want, or what they probably want, if you could possibly impute what they wanted on the basis of what you know about them, those decisions are left up to state courts in the United States. After findings of fact, the Florida state court system has made a decision that there is clear and convincing evidence that this poor woman is in a vegetative state. And there's also clear and convincing evidence that had she been aware that she would be in a vegetative state, she would have chosen to die and have the feeding tube removed. Now, we can debate whether the Florida courts are right or wrong, but that is the finding of fact. That is what the Florida courts did decide. And this was a long, drawn-out, believe me, a long, drawn-out evidentiary trial, and there were appeals in the Florida courts, and three times it went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court denied what's called certiorari. The Supreme Court said, no, we will not review this case. It came up three times because it came up in various forms. Her parents just didn't want to accept the findings of fact and continue to appeal. That's the case. That's where it was until this weekend. And what happened this past weekend was that because of public clamor, because there were some film clips shown on television that suggested that maybe she was not in a vegetative state, but again, it's film clips, and the public can believe what the public wants to believe. But because of those film clips, and because of the extraordinary political power of the religious right in the United States that has made the right to life a central focus, particularly with regard to abortion rights, this issue of this poor woman became a political issue, a federal government political issue. And what happened in the dead of night, Saturday night, this past weekend, was the leadership of the House and the Senate, in the dead of night, called Congress back from a recess. The president came back from his vacation. The Senate was assumed to be just presumed. In fact, according to the rules of the Senate, you can, with a certain number of senators there, simply declare the Senate to have voted in a certain way. Congress voted a unique personal law, a law that only applies to this one woman. And this law allows a federal judge to stop what has been decided in the Florida courts. That is to require that the feeding tube be reinserted. Does not specify by what set of criteria the federal courts ought to make this decision. Creates, in other words, a completely new private right of action that governs only this specific case. If there was ever an example thank you. If there was ever an example of usurpation of the judicial role by the legislature, or for that matter, usurpation of the state role by the federal government, I cannot think of a precedent like this. And it is a dangerous precedent. Because although it applies to this one woman, you can come up, if you want to imagine, with countless instances, not only about right to life, but around almost anything, where because of political pressure, Congress passes a special law that changes what the findings of fact have been, that are fully adjudicated about somebody's rights. In fact, a strong case can be made that this poor woman's due process right, due process to law, has been violated. Now, I bring this up with you only because I want to signal to you that this is part and parcel of a much, much larger fight occurring all over the United States, having to do with religious views and politics. The fight is going to reach a zenith when the president nominates new Supreme Court justices to replace justices that are almost sure to retire sometime during the next 3.5 years. Many of our Supreme Court justices are quite old. Several have indicated that they are just about to retire. And this president will almost certainly have the opportunity to nominate several new justices. He's already nominated several appellate judges, and the appellate judges have very, very strong right-to-life backgrounds. Again, I'm going to display my ignorance. I don't know how the system works in the UK.
But in 1973 in the United States Supreme Court decided in a case called Roe against Wade that a woman has a right with her doctor to basically decide, certainly in the first two trimesters, whether she will have an abortion. This is not a government responsibility. The Supreme Court said essentially that the government cannot intrude upon this decision. In those first years after the 1973 decision, there was a lot of opposition from people who felt that it was wrong. That's fine. But there was so much opposition that that opposition turned into a little bit of a movement. But we did not see it turn into an active, large-scale political movement until the late 1980s. For reasons that I don't fully understand, but I'm going to venture with you, I hazard a guess. By the 1990s, by the time the Clinton administration was there, and I was part of the Clinton administration, by the time we were there, this right to life religious movement had erupted into a full-scale, very large-scale, political movement. And the interesting thing about it to me, and I applaud political movements, I think people should get involved in politics, but the interesting thing to me is that this movement stands for a proposition that at least I find extremely dangerous in a democracy, and that is that the wall separating church and state should, oh, can you all, you can't hear me.
The battery's gone. So you haven't heard anything I've said. You have been so polite. You are an English audience, and you've been so polite. You just stand there and nod your head, and you haven't heard anything I've said. All right, back to Social Security. No, I won't do that. Let me just say that the issue with regard to the underlying issue here, with regard to religion and politics. Is a fundamental one in the United States, and I'm sure it's a fundamental one here. We have in the United States Constitution, and you have in your unwritten Constitution, a principle. I'm sure you have it here, and that is that the government shall not establish or promote, you don't have it here, establish or promote a particular religion. If you, as an American citizen, if you want to believe in God, if you want to not believe in God, if you want to believe in many gods, it doesn't matter. You are protected in your belief. And not only are you protected, but religion is protected from the corruption and the fear of corruption of religion that would ensue if there was a political religion, if it was a theocracy. And the principle of a wall between church and state is very fundamental in the United States. After all, we were founded in large measure by people who were seeking religious liberty. I have debated in public forums on a number of occasions people like, I will mention their names, Newt Gingrich. And I don't want to put words into his mouth, but I will put words into his mouth because Newt Gingrich has said, and he represents this sort of thinking, that the Constitution provides a protection, a freedom not from religion, a freedom of religion, but it doesn't provide a freedom from religion. In other words, the argument is that we can encourage and expect and even constitutionally, legally, promote religion. You can believe what you want, but you must have a religion. You understand? The flare-ups are occurring in all kinds of places. The Ten Commandments, symbolically, in a courthouse in a southern state. Whether you have to have or can have school prayer. I remember when I was a 5 years old, I was in kindergarten, which is our beginning stage, and at that point, the courts had not really sharply divided on all matters, church and state, and I was in a public school, a state school, and because I was the shortest person in the entire school, I was cast in the Christmas pageant as baby Jesus. Now, I am Jewish, and which is not inappropriate, but I distinctly remember being in my little manger with all the Christmas songs and thinking and actually discussing with God, saying, I did not have any choice, God. This may seem, and it is, laughable in a way. And I don't mean to be extremist about it, because even on the coins, even on American coins, you have "In God We Trust." I mean, you can be an extremist about it, and I'm not an extremist. But you see how dangerous that this can be. If you really do lower the barrier between church and state, if you say there really should not be a wall, people should not have the freedom not to have religion, then you are opening the floodgates. And Roe v. Wade, that decision with regard to abortion, is the decision that has galvanized the religious right. The religious right in the United States is very central to the Republican Party. One little factoid you might be interested in is, according to recent surveys, 18% of Americans believe that the world will end in their lifetimes. 17% of Americans describe their political philosophy as being liberal. Just thought you'd enjoy that little. Now, Karl Rove, who is known as President Bush's brain, but I don't think that's a kind way of putting it. Karl Rove is a political operative who's in the White House and very, very bright. I think Karl Rove actually was in many ways responsible for the Bush victory. And Karl Rove has very, very attentively sought ways of achieving a realignment politically of American politics. And I do believe that what we are about to witness in the second term of the Bush administration in terms of a sort of religious slash cultural war is part of the process by which the Republicans are, in fact, seeking this realignment. I'm going to end with a theoretical framework, maybe that's a way of putting it for you, as to why John Kerry lost, why George Bush won, and why Karl Rove believes that the religious fight we're about to have is going to realign American politics. And then I'll open it up to your questions. Okay? And you can hear me. John Kerry ran for president on the basis of a set of policy prescriptions. Policy prescriptions. That is, roll back the tax cut for people earning over $200,000, use those revenues to bring the budget deficit down and make a kind of down payment on national health insurance, which, by the way, is still a very big issue in the United States. When Bill Clinton tried for national health insurance in 1994, there were 38 million Americans without health insurance. Now there are 44 million Americans without health insurance. It's a growing problem. So John Kerry wanted to do that. And John Kerry also felt that the Iraqi war was being mismanaged. In fact, we should not be going after Iraqis. We ought to be going after Al-Qaeda. And that Al-Qaeda was the culprit, and that the Iraqi war was something of a distraction. And John Kerry had a number of other policy prescriptions that, to my way of thinking, made a lot of sense. I was one of his policy advisors. But John Kerry did not put his policies in the context of a narrative about where America has been and where it is and where it is in danger of going if we don't do the right thing and where it could be going. In other words, a story. Now, I don't know British politics well enough to know the importance of narrative in the British context, but I can tell you in the American context, narrative or story is very important, because out of story comes a moral view of where you should be as a society, and out of narrative and story comes conviction. John Kerry ran a campaign of policies, and George Bush ran a campaign of convictions. And when Americans have to choose between policies and convictions, they will very often choose convictions because they don't believe policies. That is, there is a lot of cynicism in the United States, perhaps even here in Britain, about politicians who promise policies. They discount policies. But when George Bush ran a campaign of conviction having to do with Iraq and Al-Qaeda and terrorism, conviction having to do with changes in the tax code or how America could be great or how America could be more prosperous or any of these other things, those convictions, which had embedded within them moral stories, had a great deal of power. Now, I submit to you there are four moral stories in America and have been for the entire history of the United States. One is the story, and it's a hopeful story, of the triumphant individual, rags to riches, the individual who makes good. The second is also a hopeful story of the benevolent community, people coming together, Frank Capra movies. Anybody seen a Frank Capra movie? It's a Wonderful Life. Anybody seen that? Whatever. Anybody? Yes. Well, then you all know what I'm talking about. The benevolent community, barnstorming, quilting bees. Those are the two hopeful stories. And American politicians, again and again, go through American history. In every campaign, the winning candidate has told those hopeful stories. But there are two fearsome stories in the American political lexicon. One fearsome story is the mob at the gates. Those foreigners, those forces beyond our borders that are dangerous, that are evil, that are, if we don't control them, they will take us over. In the 1890s, we could go through any era. They were the Spanish. Before that, they were the French, and they were originally, they were Native Americans. And all our legends, Daniel Boone, and all of them come from the mob at the gates. And then, of course, in the 1920s, 1930s, we saw gradually the rise of the Axis powers and Nazism. I mean, these are real. These stories have to be grounded in reality. And then it became, obviously, the Soviet Union, and then it became, after 9/11, especially terrorism. But there's also another fearsome story, and it's the story of the rot at the top. I don't know that you have this story, at least to the extent that we do in the United States. It is a story about elites who are conniving against all the rest of us. The first rot at the top was George III. And we have, in our political lexicon, continued to come up with stories of the rot at the top. Democrats, during the first half of the 20th century, actually right through, almost through the Clinton administration, had very effective stories in all four of these boxes. What George Bush did in the last election, and what Republicans have done increasingly before George Bush, in fact, Ronald Reagan was the master storyteller, and Democrats don't know anymore what those stories are, but Republicans had filled every one of those boxes with their stories. Instead of the rot at the top, for example, in America, in the first half of the 20th century, and this is Woodrow Wilson, and this is even Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, but he gave it a liberal spin, and this is certainly FDR, the rot at the top were big business and bankers and Wall Street conniving against the rest of us. But then the rot, certainly after the Reagan administration, became government. Not business, government. And now what has happened, the rot at the top, and this is especially true, you see in the last election, have now become liberal elites. The coastal elites. The people who eat brie and order lattes and visit France. I'm not kidding you. I mean, this is laughable in a way. But one of the major charges against John Kerry was that he was too French. He was too elite. The Chardonnay and Brie set, they said again and again. The coastal university towns, Berkeley, Cambridge. You see, the liberal elites, and you listen to right-wing radio in the United States, and you watch, if you can bear it, right-wing television, and you see and you hear again and again accusations about the new rot at the top. And the new rot at the top are liberal elites who want to impose their cultural values on everybody else. And those cultural values that they are imposing, part of those cultural values, a big part of the cultural value, has to do with godlessness. Godlessness. Remember, we used to call in the United States the communists, godless communists. Godlessness is part of the rot at the top and also the mob at the gates. And liberal elites are imposing their cultural and moral views, their immoral views, on everyone else. Last year, my elder son, our elder son, and I drove across the United States through what is now colloquially known as Red America, on my way out to California. And there's no sign on the road, by the way, that says you are now entering Red America. Red America is the way we describe the states that voted for Republicans, starting with George Bush in the year 2000. It's kind of odd, isn't it, that they call Red America? But that's the way it just came up on the voting charts that the networks were using. And they have become Red America versus Blue America. And Blue America are the coastal areas and the urban areas. And the Red Americans that the Red Americans that I visited with in my kind of trip across Red America January a year ago, and my wife Claire and I, again, we went right through with displaying great courage. We live in a blue state, in one of the bluest of blue states. We live in the bluest town, Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the bluest state, Massachusetts, in blue region of America. And we were going to, and I was going to, Berkeley, California, which is the bluest city on the blue coast of the left coast of America. From Cambridge to Berkeley, we went right through Red America, and my son and I would stop, and people would come up, and they would say to me, weren't you George Stephanopoulos. No, I said, no, Robert Reich. And then they say, but then they would actually invite themselves up. This happened about 10 or 11 times. This is a free-floating focus group. And they would say, these are red Americans. These are from red states. This is just before the election. This is actually a number of months before the election. They said, you're a Democrat. And I said, yes. You must be, the way you said that, a Republican. They said, yes. I said, well, tell me something. What don't you like about Democrats? And I listened carefully, and I got the same response every time. And the polls bear me out. They said Democrats are immoral. I said, why are Democrats immoral? And they said, well, you're not, of course. But Democrats are immoral because, and they gave me the same three answers in the same order. And those answers were gay marriage, abortion, and Monica Lewinsky. Displaying not exactly parallel logic, but nonetheless, I thought it was kind of interesting. And then as the election unfolded, I kept hearing the same thing. Coastal elites, liberal elites, Democrat liberal elites, John Kerry, Democratic liberal elite, Chardonnay and Brie, immoral, immoral, gay marriage, abortion, all put into a framework. But instead of the Democrats coming back with their own stories, and there would be, in terms of the rot at the top, let me suggest there is a very powerful story. And that powerful story is that we have not, in the United States, seen this degree of concentration of wealth and power since the 1880s or 1890s. We have not seen this degree of corruption of our political process by money, much of it from large corporations, since the 1880s or 1890s. We have not seen corporations, beginning with Enron, so fundamentally corrupted even inside the companies in terms of looting the companies and tossing thousands, tens of thousands of workers out on their faces. We've not seen executives in the United States paid not 20 times the average worker's salary, not 40 times. When I was growing up, it was 20 times. Not when I came into government initially, it was 100 times. 500 times what the average worker is now earning. Talk about a rot at the top that Democrats could talk about. But the Democrats have not. And I think that when all is said and done, over the next 4 years, the fundamental question for me is not what damage the Bush administration is going to do. I know that policy-wise they're not going to do very much damage, but in terms of the fight over cultural values, religious values, they are going to, if they have their way, try to draw a very, very, very clear cleavage between Americans in quite a hostile way that is going to leave Democrats with no room to maneuver unless Democrats fight back, unless Democrats tell stories, true stories, that are powerful and provide their own narrative. Finally, a prediction. I know you want to know who I think is going to be the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee. I will tell you. Because I am known of something as a soothsayer. In 1990, on national television, I was asked, who is going to be the Democratic nominee in 1992, and who is going to win the election? And I said, Bill Clinton. And the interviewer said, who? Nobody knew him at that time. But I will predict for you. If the election were held today, the primary elections, Hillary Rodham Clinton would be the Democratic nominee, and Jeb Bush would be the Republican nominee. It will be another Bush-Clinton fight, which means that all the old bumper stickers are still useful. And on that uplifting note, I will end my formal remarks and invite your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Now, we have microphones. We have microphones that are traveling around. There's one microphone back there, and there is some microphone up there somewhere. So if you just raise your hand, and the mic, the traveling microphone, will reach you. Or else I could just, as long as I hear your question, I could repeat it. In fact, even better, I could turn it into a question I can answer. Yes, sir.
Military adventures in the near future. But what about the current military adventure? When will it end? If we follow your logic, there is going to be more spending and more problems for the Republicans. When do you think the current military adventure in Iraq will end?
Well, the American public does not have a great deal of tolerance for the current Iraqi war. I believe that there's going to be a great deal of pressure on the administration as soon as it can, with some degree of credibility, show that the situation is stabilized to begin moving troops out. Now, that's, again, the delicate issue. I cannot overstate the importance of the Iraqi election. That election that looked as though, and perhaps in truth it was, quite successful, that gave the administration enormous credibility in terms of its Iraqi policy and bought from the American public more patience with regard to the withdrawal. Yes, ma'am.
I heard you speak about a year ago in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And you gave a very, very optimistic talk, actually, to
about a year ago.
A class
of
mine,
optimistic.
Yeah. Very optimistic. But it was before the election.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering, the tone has been a little bit different today, and I'm wondering if you
mean
still think...
I sound less optimistic.
A little bit less optimistic, yes.
About John Kerry's chances.
Definitely in that respect, but about the future of the United States and my future as well. And so I'm just wondering if you still think the liberals will win the war.
Well, I'm very optimistic because if you actually pay any attention to reputed polls and focus groups, I mean, American public opinion does conform to a bell curve. It is not polarized. I mean, the elites are polarized, but public opinion around most issues is a bell curve, and the median point in that bell curve is actually quite liberal, even though most people don't call themselves liberal. If you ask people about issues of church and state or abortion, cultural issues, you ask people, are you willing to pay more taxes for better schools? You ask people almost any question. Should there be the working poor, or should everybody have enough money through the earned income tax credit and a higher minimum wage so that everybody who works full-time ought to be out of poverty? Ask any of these questions, and the median is actually on the liberal side of the agenda in that bell curve. But what has happened is the elites, and I'm talking now about the media, some academics, professionals, the elites are very polarized. And so what the American public learns is through the prism of a highly polarized set of elites. And unfortunately, it learns a lot of the wrong lessons and the wrong facts through the right-wing media, right-wing radio and right-wing television. Again, to the extent that you may have heard of, and I think he has some influence here as well, and I don't mean to pick on him, Rupert Murdoch? But he's not alone. I mean, the Fox television news, so-called fair and balanced, which is actually exceedingly right-wing, is being replicated by other cable news, Rush Limbaugh. It's a formula that advertisers find attractive because it seems to work. But, of course, advertisers are always looking in the rearview mirror. They don't want to venture into the new possibilities, like there actually might be a progressive audience out there ready for a different message. So this is a problem. Elites are fractured, and what comes through to the public is often distorted, and much of it right wing. Yes, ma'am. The question is, what about the four narratives Democrats should tell? I suggested that the narrative about the rot at the top ought to focus on what has happened to income and wealth and the concentration and the corruption. The narrative of the triumphant individual, George Bush's narrative of the triumphant individual, is a property owner, somebody who owns assets and thereby has freedom through asset ownership. Well, I think the Democrats don't have to buy into that. I mean, I think the triumphant individual is someone who, through their own determination and work and grit, actually makes it in America. But the benevolent community, the traditional democratic story of the benevolent community, was a community that didn't give out doles to people, but actually gave them the tools, enabled them to be triumphant individuals. You go back to the GI Bill after the Second World War, or to the all of the ways where the civil rights, I mean, the entire civil rights movement was about enabling people who had the guts and gumption to triumph for themselves because society provided more opportunities for them. That's a democratic message. And the benevolent community, again, creates that possibility. What Bush has done with the benevolent community for George Bush is a religious congregation. These are faith-based groups. Now, I'm not saying that they are not benevolent communities, but they are certainly not the core of the American benevolent community. So Democrats have powerful messages with regard to these themes. The mob at the gates, well, terrorism, as we know, is a tactic. It's not as if it's a, you know, you can't go out and say it's a worldwide evil empire. I mean, it's a tactic used by very dangerous people. What Democrats ought to be out there saying is that we need a worldwide, this is why we have to have it multilateral, we need to work with other nations to police against this, to make sure that nuclear fissile material doesn't reach the hands of these people, to make sure that there is at least enough opportunity in the world, and we try to make sure that there is at least enough opportunity so we don't have the fertile soil for terrorism. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. There are people up there. Yes. Yes. Do you have a? Somebody's standing, and there's somebody.
You're a brilliant speaker, and I could vote for you, but not Hillary Clinton. But what I'd like you to comment on is justice in the Middle East and what Bush is going to do, and especially for the Palestinians.
I am surprised, frankly, that Ariel Sharon has become something of a vehicle for focusing on maybe a Middle East peace. With the Bush administration, as you know, turned its back for the first 2 years on any kind of peace process whatsoever. But without Arafat, and with Sharon actually becoming much more moderate, there may be a possibility, I think the Bush administration ought to be doing everything it can with economic suasion, with persuasion, with its own political capital. Obviously, it's a huge political capital in the Bush administration vis-a-vis Israel. But what Karl Rove wants to do is very different. What Karl Rove wants to do is do exactly what he wanted to do in the 2000 election, and that is split the American Jewish community down the middle and make the Bush administration look like it's hardline protecting Israel and say to those Jews who care only about the protection of Israel, this is the best way of doing it. And say to other Jews who are concerned about maybe this actually is inflaming and radicalizing the entire Middle East and making Israel less protected, have those Jews, if they want, join the Democratic Party or continue to stay with the Democratic Party. You see, that cynical Karl Rove strategy does not build into it a Middle East peace process whatsoever. Yes.
Yeah, I'm an American.
What are you all American? What?
No, I'm.
You're American. You're American.
I took advantage of the business climate in the States to retire early and get a graduate degree here. But I wanted to go back to the Terri Schiavo situation, and I'm a little alarmed because I am very much a pro-choice person. And I think we've had a history over the last 40 years that, for example, civil rights and the pro-choice situation would not have developed had not the federal court stepped in and taken precedence over the state courts. Now, having had a business in Pinellas Park, which is where Terri is, the story I don't see getting out there is that her husband is living with another woman, has two children, received a multi-million dollar settlement, has refused to spend it on her rehabilitation, and we are you know, going back to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I think this is an appropriate, I hate to disagree with you, but I think to say let's go to the federal courts in this regard, I think is a it had to happen in civil rights, it had to happen in the abortion issue.
Let me respectfully but strongly disagree with you and explain to you why. Ma'am?
Yes.
You see, in the civil rights situation, you have Congress enacting in a normal legislative process backed by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution legislation protecting the rights of an entire minority from the possibility that they would not be respected by the states. Here, you have Congress, without any legislative history, without any hearings, enacting a bill without any statutory instructions as to what is to be done that is directed at one single person, and it is after a state has already made final findings through its own judicial process. But can I stress with you? Can I stress with you? Yes. Well, can I stress with you? I understand that you feel strongly about this, and I respect that. But let me state once again that civil rights was not about findings of fact at the state level, and it was not about Congress enacting a law that affected one person, only one person, and it was not about Congress doing this without any findings of fact justifying that law, and it was not about Congress creating a new right of action after all of the litigation has proceeded about whether this woman was in a vegetative state or not. This is completely different from habeas corpus, and it's completely different from civil rights. This is a factual finding at the state level as to what her state was. This is not civil rights. This is not what happened in the civil rights movement. Respectfully,
I lived through the civil rights movement. Yes. I think the next question has got to be, if there are any Brits here. Yes.
I just wanted to ask you, with the benefit of hindsight...
Oh, you are not American.
I'm not American.
Oh, yes, good. No.
Having had with Clinton one of the great narrative storytellers and most persuasive, and then gone into the election and seen with the benefit of hindsight, I presume, how powerful the need for these narratives was, why was it that this kind of... Kerry didn't take this kind of pitch in the election? Why was he not...
Well, that's a good question. Why didn't Kerry understand the importance of story and narrative in terms of conveying conviction about who he was and what America needed? And I think the problem there, I don't want to get too psychological and personal, I think that he, like other politicians in American history, simply don't understand quite the power of conviction. And John Kerry also, I think, was unable to articulate, maybe even for himself, but certainly for the country, a sense of what he stood for, other than these isolated policies. And what I want to emphasize with you is that policies in isolation mean almost nothing. They are discounted. Policies have to fit within a narrative if they're going to be understood. Now, the Democrats, this goes back to having the courage of your conviction. I mean, Democrats, to my way, and I don't want to tar every Democrat, but Democrats, at least in recent years, have not presented the American public with a picture of a group or a political party that has the courage of their convictions. The Republicans, to their credit, although I completely disagree with their convictions, the Republicans have presented the public with a party that does have the courage of their convictions that is almost a movement. Now, again, it's grounded in the religious right, and it is financed by big business. But it does come across as having some clear principles and ideals. And that, to many Americans, particularly at a time of uncertainty, when the economy is uncertain, jobs are uncertain, families are uncertain, when everything is topsy-turvy, people are attracted to conviction. Yes, sir.
You started off your talk saying that you shouldn't expect anything from this administration because of the economics involved, that the budget deficit prevented anything from happening. But you also talked about the falling dollar. And wouldn't a real economic crisis give the Democrats an opportunity to... get rid of this entire administration and everything that it stands for?
Yes. I wouldn't want to wish on the United States an economic crisis. I mean, if there really was a run on the dollar, it affects not only the United States, it just affects the entire world. You know, everybody, what do? We all invest in gold? I mean, the entire global economy could be really badly affected. And although I have fairly strong political convictions, I would not want to in any way inflict that on the country. No, I think before we got to that point of a run on the dollar, we would get to a point where long-term interest rates started squeezing Americans. And that squeeze, in terms of falling living standards, a slowing economy, that would make it more difficult for Jeb Bush, assuming that he's the nominee, to be elected. It would make it more easier for the Democratic nominee to be elected. I think that's a more likely scenario. Yes. Well, the question is, are we seeing the shift that I'm already talking about, embodied, symbolized by Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, beginning to talk in religious terms. And I don't have any objection to celebrating religious people. That's fine. In fact, I think that's very important. But once we begin talking in religious terms about public policy, that is, when public deliberation becomes a question of biblical interpretation, then we are in terrible trouble, because deliberation no longer yields to compromise. And that's one of the problems with religion mixed with politics. It's not only that it corrupts religion and corrupts politics and makes it difficult for minorities who maybe don't have any belief in any religion or maybe have minority views in religion, but it also corrupts public discourse. I mean, I don't know what a particular passage in Deuteronomy means, but I don't want that to be the subject of political discourse. I don't think that's what Hillary Rodham Clinton is doing, by the way. But there is a potential danger, of course. Yes, sir.
During the debate, the debate showed that when Kerry is equal to Murray and Bush, and goes unedited, and someone holds Bush accountable, that we have a message, that Kerry has a message that is winning. I mean, he was behind in the polls, and at the end of that, it looked like he might win. So my major concern, or big concern, is that the Republicans have this increasing control of the information, people's perceptions. So anyone who criticizes the Republican administration will be attacked.
Yeah. Well, let me just respond to that by saying you're absolutely right, but I think that Kerry's problem was not only that the swift boat veterans and the media, the right-wing media picked that up and he didn't respond quickly enough. No, I think that there is also this power of conviction, power of narrative that he missed. Al Gore had more of it. I don't know how many of you remember, but toward the last months of the 2000 campaign, Al Gore started talking about the rot at the top in democratic terms, started talking about this being a contest between the people and the powerful. And his actual polls start going up. The rot at the top story is a story about American populism. That is, a story that as long as it's not exploited for purely demagogic purposes, as long as people actually recognize the truth in it, it's a story about elites that may be holding people back. And Al Gore, I think, truthfully began to talk about it. But Democrats, after the 2000 election, criticized Gore mercilessly for being a populist and said what Gore should have done is move to the center. Never underestimate the power of the dominant lesson that is assumed to come out of an election, because that becomes the predicate for the next election. Democrats keep on moving to the right. Republicans stay put. The center keeps on moving to the right, because every time the Democrats move to the right, the center moves to the right, by definition. And if you stay put, you find that politics moves in your direction. Yeah, I think that if the Democrats have stories that are both true, that express the courage of conviction, yes, the Democrats will be able to get the story out. I mean, look at, as I said, the story of the rot at the top about concentrated economic power that is corrupting politics. I mean, look at Tom DeLay today. Look at the House of Representatives. That story is clearly illustrated by the corruption in Congress. This is not a hard story to convey. And even though the media, particularly especially the right-wing media, will be reluctant to convey that story, it's going to be hard for them not to. Hard for them not to. Yes, Mary.
What it reminds me more than anything else is the discussions that are going on about Islam in the Middle East. And, you know, the whole business of the disillusion with material values, the dislike of liberals, all of these things are very, very similar, which makes me have the feeling that this kind of religious phenomenon and ideas does have something to do with the kind of global society we're moving into, and may be much more profound than simply a set of narratives. The other thing is your point about Fox television, which I've often heard, and my view is that these commercial televisions just reflect what they think people want to hear. And what's striking when you bring up the issue of Rupert Murdoch is that Sky television here is very different from Fox television in the United States. If you think about it, during the Iraq War, Sky television was more critical of the war than the BBC, which was trying very hard to be neutral. So it seems to me, and likewise, people complain about Al Jazeera, but I think Al Jazeera reflects what the Arab street thinks. So Fox is reflecting what Red America thinks. And both those things make me think there's something deeper about this move to the right. No doubt it's been encouraged by narratives, and it'll be a very long haul if one wants to shift it in another direction.
Let me give you a more encouraging view. I do believe that globalization and technological change are very threatening to a lot of people. And in the United States, as in the Middle East, as in elsewhere around the world, there is a kind of an anti-modernist reaction. If you look at the working class in the United States, these are people who have been uprooted by plant closures, manufacturing jobs going abroad, by the Walmartization of America. These are people who are anxious and afraid. And when somebody comes along with conviction and certitude, and that's what the Republicans and what the right wing are selling in the United States, certitude and conviction, it is very, very attractive. But here's the good news. If the Democrats came along with certitude and conviction about how to restore broad-based prosperity and how to fight the economic concentrations that are in some very, very profound way undermining the security of most people and corrupting politics, people could respond even out of their anxiety to a reform agenda. I think the possibility of a reform agenda today is greater than it was before. Look at American history. American history, what happened in the 1880s, 1890s, with the robber barons. A great deal of anxiety, huge, huge urban poverty, and out of that came the progressive movement. What happened in the Depression? A great deal, huge amount of anxiety and insecurity, and out of that came the New Deal. I mean, in the American context, and I don't know, and I can't speak for other cultures, in the American context, the response, if given a strong populist and progressive alternative, is to adopt that reform agenda and not be reactionary. So that's my positive spin.
Robert, I think we should probably wrap this up pretty quickly and feed you your dinner.
I think we should wrap this up fairly quickly.
Okay. What about one more question?
Okay. One more question, and let's take it from somebody up there. Yes, sir. And I hope that I don't want to put any pressure on you, but I'd like this question to be a kind of question that enables me to summarize everything I've said and put it in a kind of very, very broad context that enlightens everyone. Yes.
I apologize. Although I find your argument about narrative very convincing, is there another narrative, which is that Karl Rove and Bush merely fiddled the election? And then when polls stated a Democratic win, when Maine was first called with its four delegates as Democrat, that was actually true. And Maine changed, one of the delegates went Republican. The polls were confounded. When that happened, that was as a result of Bush fiddling the election.
The two of you are probably wrong. I don't rule out the possibility of a fiddle with the election. We saw what happened in Florida in the year 2000. But the margin in this election, unlike 2000, was sufficiently high that it seems to me unlikely that those fiddles, and I'm sure there were fiddles, that the fiddles would have mounted up to a, actually, if you made sure that every vote was absolutely accurate, that John Kerry would have won. I find it, given the margin, very, very difficult to believe. I think what Karl Rove managed very cleverly was to find groups of voters that previously, although Republican-leaning, had not been activated. I mean, we had a very high voter turnout, unusually high voter turnout, and a lot of counties that are basically Republican counties that had not had previous histories of high voter turnout had high voter turnout. And yes, it's possible to believe that they were fiddled, but most of the very good journalism that I believe occurred and interviewed people in those counties said that actually Republican operatives were there. They were there for a long time. They were organizing under the radar screen. The Democrats didn't see any of this. The exit polls, by the way, the exit polls on election day did show that John Kerry was leading. But those exit polls are in very many ways, obviously, we now know, but also you could have predicted, were quite biased. The people who would talk to exit pollsters, what they would say, how they said it, the questions that the exit pollsters actually used tended to lean one way. Believe me, if there were any kind of conspiracy here, I would probably smell it, having spent half of my adult life in Washington, and I don't. I think the issue for the Democrats was a failure to provide a powerful enough story, policies that fit into a powerful narrative, courage of convictions combined with a right-wing media that took issues like the Swift Boat and blew them way out of proportion. But behind all of this, and here's where your question is brilliant in terms of allowing me to summarize everything. Behind all of this, it seems to me, is a large and growing issue that America is going to have to face over the next 4 years. Not the deficit. That's going to automatically be faced because the dollar is going to drop and long-term interest rates will rise, and it will almost automatically have to be faced. That's why the Bush initiatives, the policy initiatives, are not the issue. The issue that's going to have to be faced is this issue of church and state. And the Democrats, I think, must face it absolutely squarely and head on and stand up for the proposition of the separation, or for the separation of church and state as clearly as possible. Thank you all for your patience.
Thank you very much indeed.